The Telegraph Cycling Podcast, brought to you by Trainer Road, cycling's most effective training tool.
Yeah, it's been a huge year for me, you know, winning E3 and such a great tour, getting married, honeymoon, book coming out and everything. But I think the highlight has to be winning podcast Pedaleur de Cham award, for sure. That T-shirt, it's pride of place in my wardrobe.
With exclusive interviews and the best analysis on two wheels, this is the Telegraph Cycling Podcast.
Hello, my name's Richard Moore. I am with Lionel Burney.
Hello, Richard.
And Lionel, where are we?
We're in the Marylebone Hotel in London.
And we're here because?
We're going to see Geraint Thomas of Team Sky and Great Britain.
And Wales. Yes, we're meeting Geraint Thomas here. He's got a new book coming out, The World of Cycling According to G. It will be out by the time you hear this, but we've got an extended conversation with Geraint, hoping to cover lots of things from his childhood in Wales to becoming Olympic champion, and in particular this year his breakthrough performance at the Tour de France and what that means for him looking to the future.
Well, let's go and meet him, shall we?
Let's go. So Geraint, it's been quite a year for you. You've got a book coming out, big win at E3, marriage, Tour de France, extraordinary performance there. How does it feel now to have your own book coming out?
Surreal, to be honest. We only started even working on it Christmas time, so it's real fast turnaround. Well, I don't know how long it takes to do books, but it seems fast and just a whirlwind, really. It's kind of, like you say, it was an unbelievable season just professionally, and then obviously getting married and honeymoon and come back, and then all of a sudden I'm talking about this book and people are reading it, and it's kind of strange. Like, I did a lot of work on it and with Tom and proud of it and everything, but it's when people start reading it, then that's when it's a bit like, oh, it's a bit real now. Some nice comments so far anyway. So
Tom Fordyce, who you sort of collaborated with, from Tom Fordyce of the BBC, it's a kind of curious mixture, I guess, of autobiography but also your tips, the rules according to Geraint Thomas regarding, you know, everything from socks. So it's a mixture, it's not just a straightforward autobiography, and it's funny as well. Is that what you were aiming for?
I've always said, like, I don't want to write an autobiography, you know. I'm not like, I don't know, I've always thought it just a bit weird, you know. I didn't grow up running away from hippos or whatever Froomey was doing in Africa, you know, or it wasn't that interesting, much older. It was just nice. It was a normal kid. It wasn't some X Factor story, you know. But then when Tom Fordyce and Luke, my agent, sort of mentioned the idea behind the book, it certainly seemed a lot different, and you can pick it up and just read any chapter, and it's just, my feelings, really, and what I enjoy about, you know, racing in Belgium, Italy, the Olympics, riding in the rain, you know, wind, climbs, descents. It's just sort of the whole sort of my world of cycling, really, yeah. And all sort of put into there, and it was certainly good doing it. You just remember so much more stuff, like once we started writing it and Tom got sort of the bones of the structure there and sort of reading it, and it brings back more memories. And the chapters on, like, Cav and Dave B and stuff were good to do as well. Like, especially brought back memories of Cav and, you know, reminiscing about Academy days. And there's nothing, like, controversial or anything like that either. I didn't want it to be, like, you know, a lot of books to kind of try and get an angle to try and sell a bit more and stuff. But I just wanted it to be not nicey-nicey, but just they're my mates, you know?
Mm. Well, it's very... I mean, I think the chapter on Cavendish, Chris Froome as well, is a very interesting chapter. Chris Froome and Wiggins and Dave B. But the chapter on Cavendish begins with a story about Colander, and you know, that goes back to when you first got to know him, I guess, in the house in Manchester. You were both part of British Cycling Academy. You were a year younger than him. He'd been in the academy a year longer, so you came in as a sort of, you and Matt Bramier, I think, were the slightly younger riders, yeah, in that setup.
Yeah, Bramier was the same age as Cav, actually, but I was the only one my age that year, and it was the first time I moved away from home, you know.
And what was the story of the Colander?
Well, everyone knows what Cav's like. And he just always used to have a go at Ed for... Well, Ed wouldn't really wash up properly anyway, but he'd always shout up the stairs, you know, about how many sides does a colander have, Ed? You know, you've got to wash it properly. And it was just one of those things that always just sticks in my memory. And whenever I'm washing a colander, I just think of Cavan.
Quite unusual for a 19-year-old, isn't it? I mean, it just shows he's always been a bit different, hasn't he, Cavendish?
Yeah, certainly. He certainly knows... what he likes, and he has strong opinions and stuff, and that's what makes him so special and good for the sport, I think.
Well, I was going to say, it's kind of a window into the life of a professional rider. That's sort of the banter and the atmosphere and the teammates and the rivals and competitors. Thinking back to when you were a kid, just getting into cycling, is the world of professional cycling anything like the world you imagined it to be when you were just getting involved when you were a kid with Maindy Flyers?
Not really. I think, you know, when you're a kid and you're outside of it and you're growing up and you're dreaming of being there, it seems like this real... It is amazing, but I was going to say it's amazing kind of different world, and it's not that different. It's like, you know, we're just normal guys, you know, just happen to be a bit better than the average person at riding a bike. And, you know, I'm still doing it with all my mates like it was back then. You know, Swifty, Stannard, Luke Rowe, Pete. I think we're really fortunate that that sort of happened somehow. But when you're a kid, you're always, like, the bus is pulling up and stuff, you know, and it just seems like a completely different world, whereas, you know, we're just sat on there and just... I don't know.
Do you remember the first race you went to see as a kid?
I went to see Amstel twice, actually. I must have been 14, 15. It was on when it was a flat finish. I think Zabel won one of them, and the other one was Bogard. But yeah, I remember just going out there and just being, you know, they're flying past you on the climbs and running after the bottles once they've thrown them in the feed and stuff. Proper fan.
So when you see kids coming up to you, you know, and they're asking for a bottle at the tour or whatever, you presumably you remember what that feeling was like.
Yeah, definitely. And I always try and give it to a little kid rather than, you know, the middle-aged man who's running alongside you trying to grab one. And same, like I've said before, like in the book, when with Rob Hales, and I remember getting his autograph, and then all of a sudden you're competing with him for Olympic place, and kind of a fast sort of progression, and it just happened overnight, it's felt.
How did you actually get started? I mean, what was it that sparked your interest in cycling and not football or rugby?
I got into it just, I was going swimming down local leisure centre, and they had an outdoor velodrome there, big concrete thing down in Maindy, and just went along, made some good friends, enjoyed it, then started winning and making a little bit of pocket money on weekends, and that sort of helped, obviously. And I was playing football and rugby in school, but, you know, the boys started growing a bit more than me, and you know, the knocks started hurting a bit more, and you know, I was like, well, I can maybe win 50 quid on Saturday, I might just stick to the cycling lark. And I stopped swimming once they wanted to be go in the morning before school, because I couldn't hack that. I'm not really a morning person.
Did you feel quite quickly that you were, there was something you were quite good at?
Yeah, because I was winning stuff, and but I never really thought, you know, I wanted to be pro and stuff, but it didn't really think, oh yeah, I can actually make a career out of this and solely do this, until I was like a junior, really.
There's a sort of sliding doors moment that you mention in the book. You know, you obviously, you do very well, you're riding on the track, you start to compete in a foreign country, i.e. England, and then further afield as well. But there's a moment, at the time, Shane Sutton was the Welsh national coach, and he advised you not to join the British Academy at one point and to go and try and join a continental team instead. I mean, that could have been a sort of pivotal moment in your career.
Yeah, that was really early on, once the academy had just got going, and I think they were struggling a lot, and I think Shane only saw the bad side of things then, and then a couple of months later he rung me up and was like completely opposite, like, oh no, you got to get on the academy now, it's really going places, and etc. And Shane's always been a big part of my career, really, especially early on. You know, he's the one, when I was like 14 maybe, down in Maindy, and he came up and had a little chat to me and got me in touch with Darren Tudor, and did a bit of work experience with Darren, and yeah, that sort of really got it going.
You did work experience, did you?
Yeah. So
what kind of work experience?
Well, I was just in the office with him drinking coffee, really, and we did I actually did a max test, like an ergo test thing, so
and sounds like interesting work experience.
Yeah, it wasn't really, like, I went to travel agents with him because he was sorting out a training camp for the Welsh juniors at the time. I think I was only maybe 15 or something, 16. So, yeah, that was different.
What were your first impressions of Shane Sutton?
Oh, I was scared of him. It was a bit like, this is a, he's a character, but he's definitely got that, like, aura about him where you really sort of, you want to speak to him and you want to know what he thinks, and he's certainly an engaging sort of character, really.
What would have happened, do you think, if you had followed his initial advice, and, you know, or if the British setup hadn't existed, and you'd had to do what British riders had to do in the past, which was go on their own to Europe and join a club and, you know, turn professional and survive in a foreign professional team. How do you think your career would have panned out then?
I'm not sure. I think I probably wouldn't have ridden the track. You know, I might not have the two Olympic gold medals I got. I think I might have just, you know, gone on the road and fully gone after that. And, you know, I think I still would have turned professional and stuff, but slightly different route. So yeah, it's I feel genuinely lucky that the whole sort of British boom and, you know, the track squad and thing was just the right time for me, really.
Yeah, in terms of opportunity, I mean, you had the opportunity because there was a track on your doorstep, and then the whole British cycling thing was snowballing at a time. But it wasn't necessarily the easiest transition to the sort of professional ranks. I think I'm right in saying you had a very short spell as a stagiaire at Saunier-Duval. What happened there? Why did that not work out? I mean, it was a day long, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was one race. It was through Dave and...
Dave Miller, that is.
Dave Miller, yeah. And I'd just been done the track Euros, so I was fat, really big, fatter than I am now even after 3 weeks off on honeymoon. But I went along, it was some real hilly race. I think it was the day after San Sebastian. It was just terrible. I didn't finish, stopped on the first time up the climb. The manager, I think, at the time, Alonso, our soigneur, who's in Sky now, was there at the time as well, and he always reminds me about it. And the team manager was like, "Oh, who is this guy? You know, he's wasting his time. He's pathetic." And now this guy is like some development team in Spain somewhere. So Alonso always reminds me that of that fact.
It worked out all right.
It worked out all right, and I'm not sure he's the best for a development team.
That would have been 2006, I guess.
Yeah, and as it turns out, it was probably better that I didn't go there anyway.
Do you not have a very brief spell with T-Mobile as well? I mean, you mentioned in the book that you and Stannard spent a bit of time with T-Mobile. He made the faux pas of buying an ice cream during a coffee stop.
Yeah, that was more just a... you can have that one if you want.
I was going to say, we've been brought... You're talking about weight there, Geraint. I thought the waitress had not brought me a biscuit because of, on account of my girth, but there's some more biscuits here.
But you've got a little flapjack there and you're offering it. I mean, that's dedication. You're obviously getting back into the routine.
Yeah, well, all good intentions. Start of the week, I was going to have a detox week and sort of really be clean up because I feel terrible after a couple of weeks in America on honeymoon. But yeah, it hasn't really gone to plan so far.
There's still time.
Hang on, did we get to the bottom of the T-Mobile episode? Just finish that. We'll change tack.
Yeah, so that was through Heiko. He set up like a development sort of side of it. So we were never raced for T-Mobile then. It was just go to some training camps and do a few races in Germany through Heiko, so crits. And that was it, really. But yeah, Matt, like Jan Ulrich, and well, all the guys were there. I remember just being in the sauna there and, you know, proper German, all there walking around naked, and me, this British Welsh lad, like, oh, no, I can't do that. I need to keep some sort of clothing on.
There's also a bit in the book where you talk about the Italian massage, too much oil and an occasional slippage. But people can read the book for more detail on that. Anyway, Lionel, sorry, you've got a mouthful of flapjack now. This was bound to happen, wasn't it?
After you.
Oh, God. We were going to change tack.
Well, the year you've had, I mean, the Tour de France you had, and then the end of season, obviously getting married, a big change. You know, a big sort of life change there. And coming to the end of this season and looking ahead at the next, I mean, I've already seen on your book publicity tour, people are latching on to the quote that you think you can win the Tour de France and all of that. So talking about the winter, I mean, you've obviously enjoyed your winter, you've had a honeymoon. So the mindset of getting back into it, how does that all kind of work now?
Pretty easy, to be honest. I'm itching to just get into that routine again, you know, because you live it like easily 11 months of the year. And so as soon as you start, if you go off that and you're eating rubbish and you're waking up at random times, going to bed at random times, you actually crave that routine and that clean living again. So that side of things is easy, really. But like you say, with the whole tour thing, that was I did laugh when I saw that quote, because it's not really something I'd go around saying, but it was just in that interview, it was kind of the guy was asking me, you know, I was just saying that commit fully to the tour. I think, you know, if I'd done that this year, I think a podium would have been, you know, close. And you never know, like if a tour is better for me, then obviously it'd be you know, a few time trials, which there is next year. It's exciting, but every year is different. But I think confidence wise, it certainly did me the world of good last year. And yeah, we'll just see how it goes.
What meant more to you this year? Your win at E3, Harold Beck, which was, you know, sort of breakthrough for you. Sort of flashing back again, there was a moment in the season where the three opening sort of cobbled classics, if you like, Het Nieuwsblad, Kern, and Brussels Kern, E3, were won by three Academy riders, you know, Stannard, Cavendish, and you, all coached by Rod Ellingworth, going way back. And that was an incredible sort of moment, I guess. Coming of age, you mentioned in the book as well that when teammates win, you feel 99% happy and 1% jealous. So it must have been nice to sort of get even with those guys as well there.
Yeah, definitely. Like I say in the book, that, you know, I won Algarve and then Stannard won, and it's kind of, I was over the moon for him, but it was like, well, I want that feeling again, you know. It was like, you know, he stood on that podium and he's, yeah. So, yeah, then to win E3, like you say, it was massive for myself. And I thought you were going to go down the route, would I choose that or the performance in the tour?
That is exactly what I was going to ask. Yeah, well done.
Yeah.
I was going to say, which means more to you at the end of the year, that win at E3 or your performance at the tour?
I love asking these questions. I hate answering them. Like, it's a tough one because E3 is massive, and that was huge for my confidence, and that probably helped in getting that result at the tour. But and then obviously the tour, it sort of opened up a whole new world in a way in my eyes, you know, and really sort of given me the confidence to really go for that stage racing route, and maybe more, well, certainly more the 1 week races next year, and try and go to the tour as maybe the backup guy and think about myself a bit more in that first sort of half of the race. But yeah, it's so hard to choose. Maybe if I hung on to fourth, I would have said the tour. But that win in E3 was massive. And thankfully, well, luckily, or nicely, I'm not sure the word actually, but the organisers sent over 110 litres of Quaremont beer to my wedding. So winning that race really did help.
Wow, because you're supposed to get your own weight in beer, aren't you?
Yeah.
A year out, I think, when you turn up the race the next time, but they made an exception, did they?
Yeah, I was doing a post-tour crit and saw one of them and was like, I'll be a bit cheeky, and asked if we could get some for the wedding, and yeah, they did it. So yeah, it was really nice. 110 litres, I think that's about 110 kilos as well. So they
thought you were heavy for that race, eh?
Yeah. I won't go there. I won't go down there.
In terms of like the confidence you talked about there, how aware, obviously you'll be aware because it's you that's hitting the deck, but the reputation that's kind of grew up around the classics and you, that you always find yourself on the floor at a key point in the race. It's happened in the Tour of Flanders, Paris-Roubaix. Why do you think those crashes happened? And have you been aware that people have talked about it in the terms of, you know, you pulled off at the wrong time in key races?
Yeah, you are aware of it. It never really, it doesn't bother me. In the team, obviously, the boys have a bit of banter and get stuck into me a bit for that. But I don't really know why. It was especially that 1 year where I seemed to just fall off in each of the classics. And maybe it's a combination of just being a bit too keen and a bit too, not aggressive, but sort of a few too many unnecessary risks at the wrong sort of times. And then a good half of them were just pure wrong place, wrong time, bit of bad luck. And then the other half was maybe, yeah, like I say, and maybe just a lack of concentration at certain times. But it did, I wouldn't say it played on my mind, but at times it was like, oh, you know, you've just crashed, you're like, not again sort of thing. Like, how can this keep happening? But yeah. You know, things like the Bargill crash, obviously stuff like that just happens, and there's not a lot you can do about that. But yeah, hopefully it's changing.
I mean, in a stage race, as that incident sort of demonstrates, you can get away with it. You know, you got away with it getting Wevelgem as well, kind of, because you did crash there. I think we know why you crashed there. You were blown off the road. But we were talking to David Miller a few weeks ago about the difference between stage racing and one-day racing, and even the different personalities of the guys who specialise in stage races and one-day races. And in a one-day race, you know, everything's got to go right. You got one chance. You got to be quite aggressive and, you know, really take the race by the scruff of the neck. In the stage race, it's you can play a longer game. It, you know, it rewards patience, a bit of defensive riding and so on. Does that sort of appeal to you as well? Because you have had so many disappointments in one-day races where you've been in great form.
Yeah, I think exactly. In stage racing, it's not just one chance. In the Grand Tour, you've got 21 days to put it right. And in the Classics, yeah, it's sort of that one hit. And it's kind of, unless you're a Boonen or a Fabian in their prime, you need everything to go right to win a Classic. So, and they don't come around that often, you know. It's obviously Nieuwsblad and Kerner are big races and stuff, but to me the main ones were E3, Flanders and Roubaix. And, you know, it's over in a week and a half, well, 2 weeks now. With stage racing, you know, if something happened or went wrong in Paris-Nice, you got Catalunya or Basque or Romandy just down the road. There's a lot more to sort of go for. And that just might take a bit of the intensity out of it, but also take a bit away of the shine as well. You know, that's what makes the Olympics so special, because it's just once every 4 years.
Yeah, what is that feeling like? The nerves, the anticipation, the sense that this is your one Tour Flanders for 12 months. Yeah. Is it like an Olympic final or like a massive mountain stage of the Tour? Because, like you say, the stage races, not everyone's necessarily there trying to win. Some are using it as prep for something a bit later. But do the butterflies get really churning on the morning of those big races? And what's the feeling like in the final, the intensity of the racing? Because I think it's easy for us armchair experts to just see the race unfold on TV. But when a move goes and a rider doesn't react to a move, you know, what is that intensity like? Is it kind of the hardest moments of the season?
Beforehand, yeah, it's probably the one time you do actually get nervous. It feels like the track again when you, like, you got those butterflies, and it's good nerves though. You kind of, I think that's what the track really helps with, is dealing with that, and, you know, the mindset and how you think and all that sort of thing. And then, you know, you get off the bus and just the crowd is just like, it's unbelievable. It's so good. It's the Belgians just love it, and the whole of Belgium seems to come out, and it's just a massive buzz. And yeah, it feels like it's like your Olympic final, or, you know, at the Alpe d'Huez, where, you know, the top three are on the same time or whatever. It's huge. But once you get racing, the hardest part, to be honest, is the first sort of 100k, the bit where you want to just try and really look after yourself, not do anything, hide as much as you can, and you're just constantly assessing like how you're feeling all the time. And it's easy to sort of talk yourself out of it, really. And you know, because a lot of my career, I've been the guy working for somebody else, and my job's been the first half, or, you know, into the final sort of 40k, and that's easy. There is pressure, but it's not the same. It's, if you blow up, it doesn't matter. There's always somebody after you to take over, you know, and it's a simple job. Whereas when you're the guy with the whole team riding for you, it's certainly a different mindset, a different pressure. You need to communicate a lot more. You need to sort of just wait. It's the waiting game and not getting too keen. And then in the final, it's the easiest bit. It's just sort of, it's more just, you just go on autopilot, and you kind of know how you want to race. So if you are just, you know, say Degen Kolb, he may just like try and hide in the wheels and just get to the finish and win the sprint. Whereas I might be like, oh, I want to be aggressive today in this final. And so you just sort of, yeah, you react or you attack, or, and it just goes. And there's sometimes, like, there's been races where, like in Australia in 13, when I won the stage up Corkscrew, and I remember thinking afterwards, well, I was like I was a junior again, just thinking, oh, I'll just go now, and just went and managed to get that gap. And then, yeah, it's just sort of it's a strange feeling, because I'm actually competitive again on the road, and it was a really nice feeling, and that breeds confidence and breeds belief, and that's the progression just keeps going.
You're listening to the Telegraph Cycling Podcast, presented by Trainer Road, cycling's most effective training tool.
You talk about how much you love those races in Belgium, how much they mean to you. Will you be prepared to skip them? Is that something that you're thinking of doing next year?
Yeah, that's the difficult question at the minute, which I'm speaking to Tim and Dave about, and I can't see myself missing Flanders, even if that's the only one I'd do. I'd still want to just drop in and do it. because, you know, the last couple of years, the first Cobble race I've done is E3 anyway, so, you know, I don't think I need, like, a big sort of build-up in the Cobble races to go and do Flanders. Mm. After that, I don't know, I think it's just a shame that a lot of the big one-week World Tour races around that time as well, so, yeah, at the moment it's sort of... Stage racing is where I want to go and what I want to fully commit to, and, you know, go into the tour next year as a strong backup for Froome. But at the same time, I'll
ask you about this actually, because you mentioned, I don't know if it's a joke in the book, that your 2012 year was built around track success at the London Olympic Games. You rode the Giro, and you sort of hint in the book that you missed the Tour de France for reasons other than we thought. But is that a joke?
Oh, what?
A speeding ticket? Oh. A court appearance?
That was actually true, but it's not the reason I missed the tour. But yeah, that was not ideal. Yeah, obviously because I got it in Cardiff, and after Christmas I was away, and that bill was all these letters and all these final reminders and all these demands were just sat on my doormat. So for months.
What? So it got a bit out of hand.
Yeah. Well, basically, I had to go to court and. For the speeding fine and stuff, it was only like maybe 5 mile an hour over the limit or whatever. But yeah, it wasn't ideal. I had to write a long letter explaining why and all this stuff. So it was all right, but I wound up the team and Dave about it a bit. But
Geraint Thomas, MBE, fell on. No, not quite. But you sort of put your road career on hold a bit that year, obviously. But are you aware now of sort of the clock ticking? You know, you hit 30, you're... approaching 30 next year. So are you very aware that these next 2, 3, 4 years are, you know, absolutely critical and when you want to really fulfil that potential on the road?
Yeah, definitely. But at the same time, I kind of feel like those years on the track have prolonged my road career as well. You know, I'm not like most sort of pros who, you know, turn pro 22. Well, I turned pro 21. But... you know, most guys, 22, 23, by the time they're 30, they've had a lot of hard road racing years under their belt. And for me, it kind of feels like, because of the track, I've had easier years, really. You know, not as intense, not as full on. I think that will certainly stand me in good stead the next, second half of my career. But, I certainly feel like now I'm coming to that time where I'm getting to my real peak. You know, I've got that depth now. That you build over the years, and feel like stage racing now, I can really sort of, well, and the big one day classics, I can really sort of go there and look to perform, which is crazy in itself. You know, I was saying to Stannard like a couple of years ago, you know, it's like, mate, we're here like riding around Mallorca like we did as juniors, but we're training to try and go and win like a classic. It's nuts. It's just like, I don't know, you dream of it as a kid, but I never really truly believed it would happen. It was always been a dream and something you aspired to do, but so yeah, to be doing it is just nuts.
And in the tour, you had this, you know, you were a very valuable, hardworking teammate from day one in the tour, and then 2 weeks into the race, you're sitting fourth overall, aiming for the podium. I mean, was that a lot of the people at Team Sky, Rod Ellingworth, people said we're not surprised, you know, we've expected this from Geraint for years. But was there a moment where you sort of thought, you know, is this really happening, and had to pinch yourself? And was there a moment where you thought, what am I doing here?
The first mountain stage, that was when I was like, wow, that was incredible. But I thought maybe that was just, you know, my good day. And then Plateau de Bay, that was the time when I was like, geez, man, I was basically ridden the last sort of, I don't know, 3-4K or whatever on the front, and got all the big names in my wheel, and, you know, threw me, so showed me a few pictures the next day, and, you know, they're pulling faces and stuff, and it was just like, that was when it was like, wow, it's sort of there, you know, I belong there. And but yeah, when they came to the blowing up bit, I was always sort of expecting that, because from the start, it was just everything for Froome. Like, even on Mur de Huy and Mur de Bretagne, I sat up and lost 30 seconds or more both those days. And then, you know, 3 days from Paris and I'm still sitting fourth. It was kind of, it was bonkers.
What do you put that down to? You mentioned weight a lot in the book, and that's the sort of holy grail for a Grand Tour rider. How much weight did you sort of lose between, you know, last year and this year?
It wasn't a massive amount. I guess it was only about a kilo between this year and last year. But I think each year sort of been getting better and better, and taking a bit more and more seriously, I guess, the whole weight thing and the whole climbing thing. And then you got that depth as well, and you sort of, you know how to race and you know what to expect more. And I think it's just a combination of the whole package, really, and it just all came to a fore at the tour this year. And I said yesterday, kind of like stumbled upon it in a way, you know, like I never targeted the tour specifically, or it was always just to try and climb a bit better, or you know, go to Paris-Nice and try and win there first. And then, so yeah, it's been like I say, for the confidence, it's been done me the world of good.
Thinking about the tour and your sort of experience of the tour and your ride this year, your debut is in 2007, a tour which that Alexander Vinokourov tested positive and went home. Michael Rasmussen got kicked out while he was wearing the yellow jersey. You know, the clouds of doping were still very heavily over the tour that year and in a few years after that. Thinking about now and the sort of the spotlight that Chris Froome finds himself under when he's at the tour, and the kind of the questions, particularly on social media, about your development from supposedly a classics rider to a grand tour rider, what's the atmosphere like in the team, and how do you kind of cope with that obvious and inevitable question, I guess?
I think it brings us together for sure, the whole Froome-y, you know, with the throwing piss on him and all the abuse he gets. It just brings the team closer together, and at the tour it felt like us against the world almost, and let's go out there and prove everyone wrong. And you know, we all know we were doing it the right way, and we all have 100% trust in each other, so it kind of worked in our favour for sure, and gave us that common goal and that common enemy. It didn't make it enjoyable, but it kind of made it, well, a lot more satisfying to really finish it off.
Do you think, though, that is there some reason that a cyclist shouldn't be able to ride 4K on the track in a 260K cobbled classic and on a mountain stage of the Tour? I mean, why do people think that those three things are incompatible?
Yeah, I don't know. I think it's all riding the bike. I think if you look at my whole career and the progression, and you see each stage and how it's gone, I think it's totally... believable. I think it's just the right way, and that's what I've done. And but yeah, I think when it comes to the haters and stuff on social media and that, they'll always be haters. And I said before, with the whole sort of releasing Froome power data and all his blood tests, and you know, why is he the only one that has to do that? Why, you know, he only won, well, only, but he won that great stage in the Tour, and then you know, was kind of hanging on for the win at the end, but he seemed to be the only one getting the abuse.
Were you aware of how much he was suffering in that last week? Because he was hanging on a bit, really, at the end, was he?
Yeah, I think so. I think, you know, he had a bit of a chesty cough and things like that. And I think he was still confident. We were all confident in him. But, yeah, he certainly wasn't quite what he was at midway through, I think, the last couple of days. But fortunately, we had a strong team, and Wout and Richie really stepped up on that last day, so it was nice.
Just turning briefly to that suspicion, because if you do progress as you want to progress and be aiming for the tour podium, those questions will be asked of you. What can you do as a rider to prove that you are clean?
I don't know, it's a tough one. It's just keep doing what I'm doing, you know. I think that's the only way. I think it's more when I come to, like, when I'm 80 and you know, I've still got my results and I've still, you know, 100% clean, and that's it, really. I think I can take a lot of like inspiration and stuff off Froome, really, to see how he deals with it, because he doesn't ever really let it get to him. He uses it to sort of, in a good way, to prove people wrong and use that aggression in the right way. But it does hurt, you know, the first couple of times I saw it of me this year in the Tour, and it was kind of like, who is this guy to just say that, you know? Is, like I said earlier, you know, just look at my whole career, look at how it's sort of, it's not like I've just suddenly, boom, start, you know, being up there in a Grand Tour mountain stage. So, but yeah, I think hopefully just keep testing, and yeah, I don't know.
I mean, I guess Lionel mentioned 2007 tour, 2008 as well, and you know, I guess the sport was at a point then where people thought it was impossible to contend in the Grand Tours without doping. You must have maybe had that thought, must have crossed your mind as well, did it?
Oh yeah, I never saw myself as a Grand Tour. Well, I didn't really know how far I'd go anyway. I thought I'd always be a domestique and, you know, be doing the first sort of half the race. Like, that tour was a massive sort of like, well, what the hell is this, you know?
For a 21-year-old, it must have been pretty shocking.
Yeah, and, you know, I was kind of doing my own little race, just trying to finish every day, and, you know, there's all this massive controversy and all this stuff going on, and I'm just like out the back on my own, just trying to finish. And you know, it was you know, physically, mentally, it was completely whacked, and all that as well. It was just like, yeah, it was certainly weird. And I was actually enjoyed going back to the track then, and back with Ed and Brad, and Brad was at 07 as well. It was good having him around, and Dave. So yeah.
You seem in the book and the way you talk as well to have become quite close to Froome. You speak about him quite affectionately in the book, and you talk about yourself as a backup rider. Famously, of course, there's been issues in the past at Team Sky, between two riders both thinking they're capable of winning a Grand Tour. How will that be managed? I mean, say at the Tour next year you're the last man in the mountains, but how will you curb your instinct, your desire to win, if you feel really good and you've got Froome there who's also feeling really good? How will that be managed?
I think if I feel good, I'll just attack him. No, I think it's a tough one. I think, you know, if you look at the way Valverde and Quintana sort of, well, it's maybe not the best example because it could do a bit more together maybe, but you know, we go there to win the race, and it's highly likely that Froome's going to be the better guy, and so 100% I'll do what I can for him. And but hopefully the guy behind me who's you know, whoever, for argument's sake, let's just say it's Pete, he's the one in front of me, hopefully he can go to, you know, 2K to go, and that means I don't even have to do much anyway. So it kind of, hopefully I got a strong team underneath us as well to sort of limits the amount that I have to do. But if I got to do it, then I'll do it for sure.
Next year is your final year under contract, Team Sky. I mean, can you, you know, it's very difficult for a team to accommodate two guys who can win a Grand Tour. Could you imagine riding for another team?
Yeah, I could, but I wouldn't just want to go to a team just to have a shot at the tour, you know. It's kind of like, it'd have to be, you know, the whole setup and everything, you know, the right team around me and all that type of stuff. You know, because at the end of the day, I feel at the moment Sky is the best team to try and win the tour, training wise, and then obviously support wise as well. But I think next year is a massive year for me, really, to see how far I can take it. And you know, if come to Paris and I've, you know, had a great tour and Froome's still in the team, and you know, maybe he's signed, I don't know, I think his contract's up next year as well, then it might be like, well, have a look around and see. But you know, I won't just go to any team, you know, that have like one decent climber and no real support, because then it's kind of, well, it's kind of, why then, isn't it?
Is it, I mean, have you spoken to Chris about how next year will work? Is that a conversation that you think you'll, if you've not had it, that you'll have over the winter?
We did speak about it a bit, you know, when we were on the beach drinking cocktails after the tour. And yeah, he was just sort of, he's super keen. He was actually not as gutted, but he was really gutted when I sort of dropped out of that top 10. And I think he's super keen to try and see me. Well, he wants me alongside him on the podium. And that would be immense. And I think it's great to have him. The thing with Froome, though, he can get a bit too keen sometimes and get a bit carried away in some of the stages, you know. He wants to sort of get the whole team at the front and go real hard and all this and that, and it's just controlling him that way sometimes. But you know, if he can and he does help me sort of get onto that podium, or you know, stay in that top 5 or top 10, it would be great.
Are you growing into a sort of road captain type role? I mean, looking at the way you were the sort of last man in a lot of the climbs this year, seemed to be sort of very visible. And one of the things that we've talked about on the podcast with the sunglasses that you lost on the colder months made you like really easy to pick out on the screen. So perhaps our perception is slightly different, but it does seem like you're taking more of a kind of a road captain type role in the stage races.
Yeah, I guess, you know, I've done the tour like six times now, Giro twice, Vuelta once, and certainly feel like I've got that experience and stuff behind me. And I think, especially someone that's not, you know, when it's the team leader, if it was through me, then, you know, his emotions can, you know, get better of him maybe sometimes. Any team leader, you know. So I think the guy below that, who's still there and can see everything going on, and got a bit more of a level head. Obviously, situation still gets to me and stuff. And I remember this year, I think somebody had attacked, and I was telling Nico to go harder, and Froome wanted him to slow down, and I was like, okay, we'll chill out a bit now. And it's a role I do enjoy doing. And yeah, if I feel great, I can, you know, if Froome feels bad, I can get the boys to speed up.
And how important is it sort of as your career grows, you get to know the roads, and like, you know, you all these places become familiar. It's not, and I think people watching underestimate how important that is or must be in racing. If you know that it's a left-hand turn, or you know that a bit that isn't as flat as perhaps, you know, it looks on the profile, all of those little things, I presume, just add to your ability as a rider.
Yeah, definitely, especially on final climbs and stuff, you know where it's going to be hard, you know, if you can just hang on at a certain place, you know, it might get a bit easier or into a headwind, or it's the same with the classics, you know, now I feel like I really know those roads, and it's the same with the Alps and the Pyrenees, really, the more you race there and do those climbs, the more you remember them and know them, and and when you're racing at the front as well, you see them differently. Like when we did Mon this year, we did it in the tour previous, but I was out the back, you know, and just sort of riding up it, and you don't really take it in. And this year, I definitely saw a different climb to what I remember. I think that experience and that knowledge of all the roads certainly helps.
So the character of the climbs changes depending on where you are in the race. If you're riding up in the gruppetto, it's a different, completely different stretch of road, really, to if you're up at the front.
The crowd's different. You're riding in a big bunch in the gruppetto. You're not really paying attention to the climb or where you're going, really. You're just sort of getting up it as easy as possible, really, and saving it for the next day. Whereas at the front, you're trying to go as fast as you can, as easily as you can, and it's a completely different experience, completely different climbs.
You were going to represent Great Britain in the World Championships, and then you pulled out because you were tired. It also happened to be, for the listeners, that was air quotes around tired. It also happened to be the weekend of the rugby between Wales and England. Was there any correlation between those two events? You pulling out of the World?
Well, is Dave Began listening to this?
he's an avid listener. No, he wouldn't have got this far.
he doesn't care. He's just Sky now anyway. But no, it really was. I was just completely spent and just over it by then. It was the Vuelta was, I tweeted it, it was probably more than I could chew. And it was a long year, and it really caught up with me then. So I was really happy to sort of miss it. And even when I was at home watching the race, I didn't miss it. Like, I would have loved to have been there going well, but I knew I wasn't in the shape to do that. And that's when I knew, I was like, I definitely made the right call. But like you say, it was a nice, convenient weekend to miss, really, yeah.
Just going to ask about the spirit of Welsh sport, obviously, because you went to school with Gareth Bale, didn't you? Or you went to the same school as
Bale and Warburton, yeah. We're 2 years below me in school, yeah.
Yeah, so, I mean, you know, they've qualified for the Euros. You know, there's going to be a real buzz around Welsh sport next summer, isn't there?
Yeah, definitely. It's we're a small country, and it's sort of similar to Sky and the Tour, you know, us against the world, and, you know, everyone sort of knows each other, and it's just everyone's proud to be Welsh, and we all love representing Wales, and, you know, going abroad to England, and I think it's a real sort of community, really, yeah. And
do you know Gareth particularly well these days? Do you keep in touch?
No, not at all, actually. But I might send him the book, see if he fancies a read. But
so just to finish off, Geraint, just a few quick questions. Who, in your opinion, is the best rider that you've ridden against?
Sagan's obviously quality. Edvald, those first few years when he burst on the scene, he was just incredible. Contador, you know, you look at, well, the ones he's still got, those grand tours were, he's got a decent palmarès.
Best teammate?
Got so many good mates, I think, and all of them, you know, Luke, Swifty, Pete, Stannard, I think we'd all, like, pull our rings out for each other, really. That sounds a bit dodgy, actually.
Best leader?
I think Froomey. You just know exactly what he wants, and you know that he'll give everything that he can to finish it off.
Worst roommate?
Jez Hunt was pretty bad. He was messy. Danny Pate. But I liked the room with him, though, because he's just that quirky American sort of idiot.
Best roommate?
Stannard's good. He's although he does shower a lot. That's fine. Yeah, I know. Stannard.
Showering too much. Never heard that as a complaint.
Oh, he has like 3 a day. He's nuts.
I think that caps it. Ian Stannard showers too much.
Great. Thanks very much. Good luck. Good luck with the book.
Cheers.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the Telegraph Cycling Podcast. Thank you to Glass Pear for the music in this episode. For more information and to download more editions of the show, visit thecyclingpodcast.com.